Hi, I'm Danny Elfman.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Debbie Harry.
This is Chris Stein-Blondie.
This is Roland Orzabal from Tears for Fears.
This is Billy Idol.
This is Alex Ebert, a.k.a. Edward Sharp, giving the story behind the song.
Hi, this is Peter Chotti, host of The Story Behind the Song. Each month I speak to some of music's biggest artists to get the inside stories behind their most lasting and iconic songs. Join me for new episodes on the third Monday of every month on The Story Behind the Song from the Consequence Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Consequence Podcast Network. Welcome to Consequence Uncut, a series that gives listeners and readers a deeper dive into our features with major artists.
For this episode, we're talking to Ian Paice and Roger Glover of the legendary band Deep Purple. They'll be discussing their iconic album, Machine Head.
We had a lot of setbacks, so I think, in a way, I have a feeling that it brought us together as people and as a band, because it was us against, you know, all this bad luck. And maybe that's the secret to it. There's an energy in the album that I think maybe wouldn't have been there if we'd recorded it in a proper studio with plenty of time.
Hi, Spencer. Welcome back to Consequence Uncut. And what a wonderful reason to be here. Deep Purple. Like, this is all-time hard rock classic inspiration, a timeless album, timeless music, and some of the best guitar riffs literally ever.
I mean, probably one of the most iconic guitar riffs of all time, and that's Smoke on the Water. You know, basically the standout track on Machine Head, the album they're discussing today.
Yeah. So today on Consequence Uncut, we're doing something a little bit different. So as Spencer's the managing editor of Heavy Consequence, he's going to be here representing Greg Prado, who's one of our writers and also an author of numerous books about the rock scene.
True. Yeah. If you look up Greg on Amazon, you'll see his author page. He has a lot of books written about rock scene, about different genres, a few oral histories, very accomplished writer. And we're always happy to have him contribute to Heavy Consequence.
Absolutely. Now, Spencer, can you sort of set the scene for some people that might not be as familiar with Deep Purple, and they might not exactly understand Deep Purple's place in sort of the history of rock?
Right. Yeah. So Deep Purple preceded Black Sabbath. And while they're not considered heavy metal like Sabbath is, they are considered proto-metal. They're kind of one of the pioneers of hard rock, if you will. A lot of their guitar riffs, Ritchie Blackmore, the guitarist, his riffs influence heavy metal. And just a legendary band in their own right, and still going strong. They still play shows, which is really incredible, with three of the classic members still in the band. And this particular conversation centers around Machine Head, their classic album. They're releasing a deluxe box set with a lot of rarities and unreleased cuts that they didn't release before. And Greg had the opportunity to speak with Ian Paice, the drummer, and Roger Glover, the bassist. And they had a lot of great things to say about the album, the recording of the album, and other topics.
I know. And it was so cool just to be a fly on the wall. Because whenever we have conversations with people that have monumental hits like this, there's always that moment that's just so random that happens to inspire them. Like what happened with the song Highway Star. Like they're traveling with some journalists and he asks, how do you write a rock song? And he just makes something up on his guitar.
Yeah.
And then that somehow becomes arguably one of the better songs on the album.
Yeah, you can say that.
And that's not even as crazy as what happened with Smoke on the Water.
And then the story behind Smoke on the Water is incredible too, because they were scheduled to record the album at the Montreux Casino in Switzerland. And then Frank Zappa was playing a show there one night. And the casino went up in flames. And it, not only did it make Deep Purple change their recording plans, while they're watching the casino go up in flames, they get inspiration to write this song, Smoke on the Water. And then Ritchie Blackmore records one of the greatest guitar riffs of all time. You can't make it up.
You can't make it up. And I mean, honestly, like Smoke on the Water just sounds good just in general. But like, there's nothing like literally a fire to be like, this might be a life-changing moment that could inspire something.
And the cool thing, in a full circle moment, this box set that they're releasing has been remastered by Dweezil Zappa, the son of Frank Zappa.
Oh, yeah.
Who was playing that show when that venue went up in flames.
Oh my God. Whoa. I remember when they were talking about that, but I did not remember the part that he was actually at the show that burst into flames. This is incredible. Well, okay, so I feel like there's nothing more to add than just check out the interview and be sure to check out this article on consequence.net. And as always, please remember to subscribe to this feed so you can stay up to date with these in-depth interviews. And now I'll turn it over to Greg Prado and Deep Purple for this interview. Please enjoy.
So the first question I have is, do you both agree that is Machine Head the definitive Deep Purple studio album?
A lot of people want to know what was our mindset at the time. Did we think we'd, written the ultimate rock album? We just made an album. It's really, you can only look at it from the point of view of time. And you look back at it and you go, well, yes, it was. But at the time, it was just another album, We didn't know what was ahead.
Once we started recording, we knew we had some good stuff. But the way we do record is until it's complete, you really don't know. And we don't record complete songs. We create pieces of music. And then what goes on top of them, i.e. the melody, the lyrics, that's when you know what you've got. It's a sort of backward way of doing it, but that's the way it works for us. So we thought it was okay. And then when it was finished, we thought it was pretty good. But you can make the best record at the wrong time and nobody will know about it. Or the worst record at the right time and everybody buys it. Mm-hmm. So you don't know.
Yeah. Because I was going to ask, was there any sense that the album was actually special while you were working on it, or it wasn't during that recording process?
We were struggling to finish the album, but we were setback after setback. The fire and the first place we tried, the police stopped us, and then we had to find another place in a sleepy little town. We had a lot of setbacks. So I think in a way, I have a feeling that it brought us together as people and as a band, because it was us against, all this bad luck. And maybe that's the secret to it. There's an energy in the album that I think maybe wouldn't have been there if we'd recorded it in a proper studio with plenty of time.
Well, that was the problem, the time. The Rolling Crone stuck had to go somewhere else after we'd finished our booking. We couldn't say, well, let's stay another week and do it, because there'd been nothing to record it on. So that pressure of diminishing days did focus your mind a little better to make sure you got as much out of every day that you could. Because we had nothing and we had a few days to make everything. And I think we applied ourselves in a way that we probably wouldn't have done in a more relaxed situation.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's right. Mm-hmm.
And what exactly did Martin Birch bring to the sessions? Because he would later become a much sought-after producer with Rainbow and also Iron Maiden.
Roger, you do this one, because you work with him a lot more than I did.
What he brought to the band really became apparent when we were doing Deep Purple in Rock. We'd worked in a few different studios with a few different sound engineers, and it wasn't until we met Martin that we felt we'd found, the right guy. And we said right then, right, Martin's going to be our engineer from now on, because he was very good. Production is a very odd word, because it's all part of the process. And although Martin at that time was the sound engineer, and of course he did become a producer later on, but in a way he was becoming that, because listening to what we'd done was a bit of an exercise in opening doors and going across and through windows and God knows what to get to the truck to listen to the stuff. So instead of going through, which would take time, and what time we didn't have, we'd say to Martin after we'd done a take, hey, Martin, how was that? And he'd say, yeah, that was pretty good. Okay, pretty good. Yeah, well, let's do another one then. And that's how we used Martin as a sort of sounding board, if you like. And we didn't do that many takes of most songs. In fact, I think Highway Star was take two. So we were on fire for sure. But Martin helped that.
He also had a very similar sense of humor. Same generation, same cultural background. It was very easy to admit him into the band, which is not an easy thing to do, because a band is its own social circle. You don't let anybody else in there who's not meant to be there. But Martin was meant to be there. And that was very easy to work with him from that moment on.
And what do you recall about the writing and recording of Highway Star?
It's stupid, really. We were doing a, I think it was down in Portsmouth, wasn't it, Rod? I think we were going to Portsmouth or somewhere Portsmouth on the south coast.
Yeah, Plymouth or Portsmouth, I can't remember which.
Yeah. And we had a journalist on the transport with us, and he asked the most inane question of Richie. He said, well, how do you write a rock and roll song? So Richie, in his usual sort of sardonic way, picked up the car and just went, digga, 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 digga. Stop, that's how you write it. That's how you do it. Anyway, it sort of sounded good. So that night, we sort of fiddled around with it on stage. We sort of, Richie started, we just messed around with it, and with a few big looks at each other and chord changes, we put together a little piece of cacophony that the audience didn't know, which Gillan had no words for, but the effect seemed to be quite mesmeric on the audience. So we thought, well, there's something there. And that's how it happened, you know.
By the time we got to record it, that's when we, put in the finesse of putting in solos and chord changes for solos and things like that. That certainly didn't happen instantly, but it happened instantly, you know, when we were recording it.
Next time you want to write a rock and roll song, just go digga, 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 digga. It's that simple.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Is it true that the band believed that the song Never Before was going to be the big hit song from the album?
I don't know about believe, but certainly it was, you know, we knew we had to release a single. So we fell into that thing of, it's a trap, really, when you start thinking about what the audience wants instead of what you want. And I think we fell into a bit of a trap there because we tried to channel it, to make it a single. And of course, trying too hard doesn't always achieve results.
It was intended to be a commercial track on what was probably not, in the eyes of people, a commercial album. To me, it's the weakest track on the record. So even doing it, I was never really sure of it. But like good little musicians, we did as we were told and tried to give everybody what they wanted. On that one instance, we just told them all to take it, show it.
And do you agree that Pictures of Home is one of the most underrated Deep Purple tracks?
Is it underrated? I don't know. What songs do I like to play? I think that's one of them. But it's lovely to play. It stood the test of time. We still play it.
My feeling about it is I love playing it to the point that I hate playing it. Once I've had enough of it, I've had enough of it for 2 or 3 months. And then after 2 or 3 months, it'd be nice to play it again. And I don't know why that is. Very few tracks hit me like that. But once I've had my fill of it, I need to forget it exists for a little while. Mm-hmm. And after that little while, I'm happy to find it again. I don't know why.
And when would have been the first time that Ritchie Blackmore introduced the Smoke on the Water riff? And what were your initial impressions to hearing it?
Mid-tempo chug. That's how we, that first only take we did of it in the pavilion. It was just a mid-tempo, nothing special about it somehow. The riff, it was a good riff. But I mean, Ritchie's written riffs similar to that. It wasn't that dissimilar. It's only like later on you go, well, actually, it was a brilliant riff.
Yeah,
I don't think I recognized it at the time.
I thought we did two takes, but it might only be one complete take. I remember the main thing about that was because it was so long ago and it was such a short period of time. It was just the road managers keeping the police out because we were making so much noise in this sleepy little Swiss town. They could come to shut us down. But I really don't remember much about the riff before Montreux. I really don't. It was probably around and Richie may have played it, but no, nothing comes to my mind about it.
Yeah, because I was going to ask, how soon after the riff being introduced did the whole song start falling into place?
Well, that was it. That one take is the master. That was it.
Yeah.
So we must have just gone through a few chord changes, stick a solo here. We were basically trying to get a sound from Martin Birch in the truck. That's what we were trying to do. Yeah.
No, it's a raw recording. It was very simple, just four musicians. There's no vocals yet. And it was only when we sort of finished the rest of the album that Martin said, well, you're going to need one more song. And okay, well, what are we going to do? Let's listen to that thing we did in the pavilion, see if it's got any legs. And we listened to it and it's, you know, okay, fine. And so we wrote a song over it. And of course, you know what the song's about. It's the story of our stay in Montreux. But and writing the words took maybe 10 minutes. Yeah, it's very conversational. We weren't trying so hard to do anything. We were just trying to finish the album. It was the last thing we did before we had to pack up.
Yeah, because some people forget that Smoke on the Water was not released as a single. It was released as a single more than a year after the release of Machine Head. And that was actually even after Made in Japan and also Who Do You Think We Are was released. It's kind of hard to believe, like looking back now, that no one could see that that was a potential hit single.
Well, it was too long. It was too long. It was 5.5 minutes or something like that, the original album version. It took some guy at Warner Brothers to say it's a great song, but we can't get radio play. And without consulting anybody, he just got it in the studio and he edited it down to 3 minutes something, sent it out to the radio stations, and they started playing it. And it was like a huge wave went across the US. I mean, it was just spread like a shock wave. And within a couple of weeks, every station was playing it because it was the right length. Nothing to do with the music, it was the right length.
Which just goes to show that musicians aren't very good at picking their own songs.
And is Smoke on the Water the greatest guitar riff of all time?
Yeah.
It's up there. It's up there.
It's obviously, it's a matter of opinion, but it's definitely one of the top 10 huge riffs of all time, yeah.
Stone Satisfaction isn't bad. Stevie Wonder's Superstition ain't bad. I mean, there's a few that just, they're not difficult, they're just perfect. And that's the hardest thing to find, those perfect little sound bites that communicate with everybody immediately. You know, that's why there are so few of them.
And did you ever get the chance to discuss Smoke on the Water with Frank Zappa? And if so, what did he think about being name-checked in the song?
I've never met him.
I'm sure he's quite happy about it, though. Free promotion, it's never a bad thing.
Yeah, actually, it was not a very good week for Frank because when he left Montreux, he'd lost all his equipment, and all the guitars and drums and the lot went up in smoke. And a week later, he managed to replace it and did a gig in London, and someone pushed him off stage and he broke a leg.
Break a leg, Frank. Not Frank.
Not a good time for Frank.
No.
Yeah, because in A Strange Quirk, Frank's son, Dweezil Zappa, remixed the album for this collection. So if you just want to discuss how he got involved and what you think of his remix of the album.
Basically, that's Warner's Universal choice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they dreamed up this package and they thought Dweezil Zappa would be great to get involved. And so that's the way it went.
It's interesting to hear somebody else's take on it, you know. What I've always thought would be great, to each one of us do a remix of all our records. Mine would be so great for the drums. It wouldn't be true, man. It'd be so good. You wouldn't hear much else, but the drums would be fantastic.
That's why you don't do it.
And did you both prefer recording in a traditional studio or someplace else like you did for the Machine Head album?
Well,
I think. Yeah, go on, Roger. Go on.
Okay. The idea was to get out of studios because nearly every studio that we had access to in the UK wasn't built for rock and roll. It was built for acoustic instruments or spoken word. I mean, the control rooms are fine, but the recording rooms were out of date. There was no reflection of sound inside. No, they were killed stone dead. The only one that was really, really good was Abbey Road number 2, which you could never get in there. It was booked solid for years ahead. So we thought, well, look, we do play shows in arenas and big venues where the sound is great. Why don't we see if we can get out of the studio, but still record with the same quality in a room that sounds good? So that was the thinking behind it. We found it so much easier to enjoy the sounds you're making because they sounded like it should sound. Right. The room had not killed it stone dead, you know.
I do remember doing Fireball. You'd change the skin on your snare drum and we're walking back towards the studio through the corridor. And the sound went from a loud crashing sound in the corridor to inside the studio, it just went duh, duh.
It's awful, yeah.
And in fact, you set up your drums in the corridor. We recorded all the drums in the corridor.
Yeah, yeah.
And Machine Head was the kind of logical next step, really.
Yeah.
If it works for Ian, then we all of us can do it.
It's not like it's a science, you know. Every room has its own characteristics. Every piece of music has its own good points and bad points, and you've got to bring it all out. And when you in rock and roll, sound is so important. And if you can get a sound that makes it work better, then that's what you've got to do. I know there are some people who love working in studios with that totally controlled environment. Simon Kirk from Free and Bad Company, he loved that. He didn't like all those reflections, but I couldn't play without them. So it's not a hard and fast rule, but we found it much easier to play in an area which made us sound like us and not some little rinky-dinky, little awful noise going on in the background.
And were there any signs during the recording of Machine Head that this lineup would be together for only one more studio album?
At that time, no. The more baggage you carry around with you, i.e. the longer you stay together, the more chances you have of personal differences becoming or seeming more important than they are. We were working so hard then, you didn't have time to think about anything else. You know, we gig, couple of days off, go in the studio, make a record, 2 days off, gig. It was labor intensive, but you didn't have time to think about what somebody else thought about the world, you know, and if his opinion on something was different to yours. These are all little things, but over the course of a couple of years, they can turn out to appear to be big things. They really aren't, but you know, you can't go back. It's a real sad thing, but once something's said, it can't be unsaid, and when something's done, it can't be undone. But at that period of time, we were having a great time. We were making what we thought was good music. It was exciting. We were increasing audiences. We were just having a wonderful time. The world was ours. So there was none of that was apparent at that moment in time, though.
And how do you think the album holds up today when you hear it?
I don't know. You tell me.
Well, it's one of the greatest hard rock heavy metal albums ever. I mean, especially if you think about how many bands have listed it as an important influence and what came after it. You know,
you can't hide from the fact that it's become basically the album that kind of defines Purple. Didn't feel like that at the time, but it's only the passing of time, and especially decades and reissues and etc. It's still the sort of the blueprint of what Deep Purple's all about.
And for a style of music that grew from it. I mean, not just us. There were other bands playing hard music at the time. Of course there were. But I think it was that blend of aggression, freedom, and dexterity musically to actually try different things and break down a few walls, you know. I mean, you take Space Trucking. Why did we stick a little drum feature in the middle of it? I had no real reason to be there, but it seemed like a good idea, so we did it. There are no rules. The trouble nowadays, music is now building rules around itself so nobody can move and do anything. All that work we did, Roger, wasted.
Oh, evidence of a misspent youth.
Yeah, who is he?
All right, and then just the last question I have is, what is Deep Purple currently up to and also future plans?
Yeah.
New guitarist is Simon McBride. Steve Morse, unfortunately, had to leave. And that's very sad. But we wish him the best, but it's changed the band. When Steve joined the band, it changed the band. Because I remember Steve saying to me, what do you want from me? I said, I want you to be yourself. You can't step into someone's shoes and be play like them and look like them and write like them. You got to be yourself. And he became himself, and it changed the band. And the same is happening now with Simon. His inclusions changed the recipe a little bit. And we've been doing some recording, and I guess something will be out later this year. So we'll see. But meanwhile, we're back on the road, as usual.
And that's all we can tell you. There's a guy, big guy with a club. If I say any more, he's going to hit me on the head. And I'll tell you, I can't show you. It's a secret. If I show him, if I show you his face, he's going to have to kill you. Sorry. There's nobody there. It's all right.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.